It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Hey guys.
Let me just plug in here because we've been having a little bit of a challenge.
All right, so yesterday we were working on doing some, what do you call it, Facebook Live. And sometimes, as it happens, it didn't go according to plan. There was just a lot of feedback over reverb sound-wise, right? So there was an echoing type of situation. And we don't want that. We want to have clear, luscious sound and, you know, not a bunch of junk. So let's see. I'm going to see if we can, we're going to try it again. So just bear with us. All right. My producers are telling me that we may have to forego the test today. And just get, you know, get the party started here. Let's see. Yeah. Yeah. Looks like we're going to, all right. Enough of that. Hey, so you know what? Occasionally people don't buy from us, right? Now check this out. 80% of the people that you work with, deal with, interact with probably don't want to buy from you right away, right? Because there's fear involved. Man, if I give this person the money, will I regret it? Will this person keep their word? You know, all that stuff that goes through the buyer's mind. And so you'll come across these things called objections. And that's not necessarily a bad thing if you know how to handle objections, right? And that's kind of what I want to talk about a little bit because it's so important. You know, when you're dealing with objections, you know, the first thing you have to do is to listen. Do not interrupt. You know, nod your head. Listen to duplicate. Listen to build rapport. And then you want to acknowledge the objection. You know, I understand. I agree with you. I hear you. Man, my wife, my husband said the same thing. I know where you're coming from. And then I always like to ask a question, other than, you know, money, other than time, other than, you know, whatever the concern is, other than that, what else is keeping you moving forward? You know, are you concerned about anything else other than XYZ? And then, you know, and that's called isolating the objection. So once you've been able to isolate the objection, you can move forward. Now, again, like I think in most presentation scenarios, the key here is questions, right? So one of my favorite things to do is to validate the objection. So let's just say price, because that's a fairly common one. Price, time, and I got to talk to my spouse or my partner about it. Those are the three big ones. So, you know, is price the only objection? Yeah, you know, that's it. That's the only thing keeping me, you know, that's the thing. I think those payments are too high, or the down payment's too much, or the price is too big. Well, let me ask you this. Do you have any other concern about moving forward with this other than the price or the terms or the payment? No, that really is it. I'm really concerned about the price. Well, let me ask you, is that really going to keep you from owning this? Is that really going to keep you from, you know, getting the benefits? Is that really going to keep you? Is that going to stop you from getting this car today? Is that really going to stop you from owning this thing that's going to deliver these wonderful benefits, right? and just be quiet. Because look, the reality is we've all bought things that cost too much. Our shoes, our accessories. You know, we have all bought things that cost too much. That's why credit cards were invented. Now, the other thing is it a real objection or is it a complaint? Man, this costs a lot of money. Yeah, it does. But quality usually does. And you probably knew that coming in. I mean, think about it. If they're at your store and they're looking to buy a leather love seat, or they're buying a car, or they're looking to make a home purchase, a financial investment, this costs a lot of money. It's just a complaint. It's not a real objection. And the best thing you could do is agree with it. Yeah, you know what? It is a lot of money. I thought the same thing. But, you know, quality usually costs money. Or, you know, what else can you say to that? Let me see. Quality usually costs money. Oh, I know. Here's my favorite one. When somebody says, man, that costs a lot of money. Yeah, but you probably knew that coming in, right? I mean, you know, cars today cost a lot of money. Houses today cost a lot of money. You know, clothing today costs a lot of money. Accessories today cost a lot of money. And then you can throw the word quality in there. Quality clothing costs a lot of money. Quality accessories cost a lot of money. Quality consulting, coaching costs a lot of money. Quality marketing costs a lot of money. But you probably knew that already. So those are kind of my insights on this whole idea of complaints, of the difference between, let's say, an objection and a complaint, number one. So let's talk about, you know, I'm glad we covered that. But also the fact that I wanted to give you some ideas on how to handle objections. Because it really doesn't matter what you're going to be selling. If you are doing what you should be doing, you're going to come across objections. You are going to be hit with objections, as you should. Now, objections are a good thing. Think about it. Objections are a really good thing. Why? Because it shows interest. If somebody was complaining about the time, about the cost, about the, you know, whatever, right? Their objection is one of those common, you know, objections. You know, I'm really excited about this, but I got to talk to my spouse. That's completely different than somebody says, you know what, I'm not interested at all. Because now you have nothing to talk about. I'm not interested at all. Well, why not? I'm just not. This is not what I'm looking for. Well, now what are you looking for? You see what I'm talking about? Now it's a completely different thing. So objections are good. Objections mean that you are on the road to a transaction. All right. That was just kind of my just some insights that to spur you along the way. And we're going to take a quick short break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Rose.
And Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
We are back. My first guest, Eddie Gevorg. Eddie is the co-owner and managing partner of Key Advisors Group, specializing in money management. Eddie also focuses on retirement estate planning strategies for his clients. He works with local CPAs and attorneys implementing tax strategies to help clients protect their hard-earned assets from unnecessary taxation. Eddie Gabor, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. You bet. You know what? I want to kind of clarify this because, you know, when we start talking about taxation and tax strategies, people, unfortunately, go to the extreme wrong way, right? They're thinking like, you know, not paying your taxes or some kind of weird tax shelter scheme. And when you're talking about, protecting somebody's hard-earned assets from unnecessary taxation, you're not talking about doing something crazy. You're talking about following the letter of the law, using the tax code to your client's advantage.
That's exactly right. There's a lot of money left on the table each year only because individuals aren't aware of some of the strategies they can do, whether it's the way that they're pulling the money out of their portfolio, the way the portfolio is managed. IRA monies many times needs to have a different strategy than non-IRA money because they're both taxed completely differently. And it's a common mistake that people make. So tax planning is, I would argue, more important for the everyday people like ourselves because every dollar you save is a dollar earned.
Yes, yes. And, you know, what I have noticed, and I want to get your feedback on this, is that this is my personal experience, that when you start looking at tax strategies, first of all, you don't realize, or I didn't realize, how much money I was leaving on the table. You know, I would think that, you know, if you spend a little time doing some taxation or some tax planning or tax strategies, you can add an extra 10 or 15% to your returns, your income. I mean, there's literally, like you said, a lot of money there.
It is. You know, when you compound the amount of money that someone can save and you compound that over their life expectancy, over 20 to 30 years in retirement, it can be a substantial amount of money that accumulates to, which indirectly makes your rate of return on your portfolio higher, just as you said.
All right, so and this is also interesting because, you know, here you are, you work with CPAs and attorneys, and a lot of people just expect CPAs, because they deal with money, they deal with numbers, to know these strategies, but that's not necessarily true.
No, many times what you'll find with the CPAs, and we're fortunate, we've got some great CPAs here locally we work with, but they're the bean counters. You know, they do it after the fact. We really look at things from a holistic point of view and share strategies with them, so that way they can look at the client's tax situation to see if that would make them save money. So really the planning is a lot of the work that we do, and then we just run it by the CPA to get their stamp of approval to make sure it fits for that particular client. So many times if you're going to a CPA to get, you know, planning strategies on a portfolio, you're probably not going to get that because, to their defense, that's not what they focus on. They focus on everything after the fact.
Yes, yes. And the thing that I've learned is that tax planning can be done, you know, before the fact, right? So it's not done after the fact as an afterthought. It can actually be part of the entire strategy.
Exactly. I think that should be a big part of everybody's strategy because I don't care what tax bracket you're in, whether you're in the lowest or the highest. I mean, you want to make sure that you're not leaving money on the table. And I'll give you a good example. You know, there's a lot of folks out there that own mutual funds outside of their IRAs that in the next year or so, they're probably going to get a lot of capital gain distribution spent out to them, even though they didn't take any money out of the account. And because the mutual fund companies have used up and exhausted a lot of their write-offs from the big losses of 2008, so now they're going to pass those capital gain distributions on to us as shareholders. And if you've got a lot of mutual funds that are not efficient tax-wise sitting outside of your IRA, that's going to be a lot of tax that you're going to pay. That's going to be a surprise.
Excellent, man. I like that. Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a huge surprise. Let's talk about this because, unfortunately, the cost of living adjustments the IRS uses is not based on real-world numbers. Consumers have seen cost of living rise. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so the numbers that the government uses when they're determining, you know, what type of increases you can do to 401k savings and other things. They use the consumer price index. So that's why I think many people will scratch their head over the last 5 years when the government comes out with the CPI index numbers, which is supposed to be a gauge on inflation, and they say that we haven't had any inflation. Well, everyday people like me and you, we're putting gas in our car, we're buying groceries. The cost of doing that, although gas has come down the last year, but over a five-year period of time, there was a time where gas prices have gone up really high, food costs have gone up, yet the CPI index showed that there wasn't any inflationary growth, and that's because they used that as a very small fraction of their calculation. So what my family and your family would look at and say, wow, our cost of living actually went up by 5%, the CPI index would say that the CPI index was flat and that there wasn't any inflation. So it's a really skewed number.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, and that's the problem with, you know, with a lot of these formulas is that you can twist them, reinvent them, manipulate them so they reflect whatever you want to reflect.
That's exactly right. So we've always argued that the CPI number that you read about in the Wall Street Journal or whatever publication you're looking at is not a true depiction of what everyday Americans are being faced with from a cost of living, because I think anyone that's listening right now would agree that the cost of living has actually been going up for them for the last several years, even though the CPI index would state otherwise.
Sure. You know what? I want to talk about this, too, since we're on the subject of, numbers and the IRS here, is I want to talk about I want to get your thoughts on what a lot of, let's say, savers slash investors, retirees, a lot of these individuals sometimes will let the fact that the IRS has not increased the limits to these saving plans deter put them off from saving more money, right? It kind of deters them from increasing what they should be saving every year. I want you to talk about this because I think this is so vitally important. Just because the IRS has set this limit doesn't mean that it's the right limit for you or your family.
No, that's exactly right. And one thing we know for sure today, because most companies have gone away with pensions and guaranteed income benefits for clients or for their employees, that burden now falls on us. So we have to have a higher savings rate today than what maybe our parents or grandparents had, because that's what you're going to have to live off of the rest of your life. And if the IRS maxes you out at a 401k, and let's say that that number is $18,000, that should not deter you from saving more than that. And I would actually say from a tax planning perspective, it actually would be beneficial for you to max a 401k, but then take the extra money you're able to save and save it into an after-tax account. That way, when you retire, you have more than one source from a tax planning perspective to pull income out of. Because if all of your money is pre-tax when you retire, that means every dollar you're going to take out in your retirement, you're going to have to pay both federal and state income tax on it. It would be nice to have a portion of your portfolio that's not treated as ordinary income. And that's another tax planning strategy that individuals can do, is just don't have all of your money in one type of category from the way the IRS looks at it. So as individuals are getting pay raises each year, even if they max out their 401k, they should definitely take a portion of that pay raise and pay themselves in an after-tax account if they've maxed out those 401ks. They will be very happy they did that when they retire.
Yeah, you know, I love that strategy. You know what, and I want to get your thoughts on this, because as far as I understand, we can have multiple retirement accounts, right? I mean, you know, you can have a 401 with your business or your job, and then you can have an individual retirement account, and then you can have an individual retirement account, I think, with for your spouse, and then you can have so you can have multiple individual retirement accounts. You're not just limited to the one or the two.
That is correct. There's a lot of flexibility in that. Now, you do have to be careful, because some retirement accounts, if you have a retirement plan through work that you're contributing to, and you also contribute to one that you own individually, you may not get the tax benefit that you would get in the 401k. So there are different caveats there that individuals should definitely, you know, consult with the CPA on before they go ahead and do something and have some unintended consequences happening. But to your point, yes, you can have several different types of accounts that are earmarked for retirement. And again, I would argue having different types of accounts that are treated differently tax-wise will allow your money to last longer in retirement because it will be less taxes you'll pay on it in the future.
Yeah, no, I like that. And again, I hope that everybody's catching what we're talking about here. Again, this is tax planning before and not after you receive the money or after you've made contributions. This is something that you do beforehand so you can avoid, as I said in the introduction, unnecessary taxation. Look, tax avoidance, and I want to make sure I say this correctly. Unnecessary tax avoidance is your obligation. You don't want to overpay Uncle Sam. He will not send you money back. He's not going to even send you a thank you. Bottom line is you want to pay what is legally owed by you after taking whatever legal deduction is right for you. And look, one of the reasons that a lot of these people that you see, like Donald Trump, like Mark Cuban, the reason they don't pay very much in taxation compared to what their net worth is because, first of all, they do tax planning, and second of all, they have different scenarios where they get to use tax deductions. Some people call them loopholes, but those loopholes are for everybody that wants to take advantage of them. Am I right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's like you said, I'll tell people, it's just a matter of running your household more efficiently. Everyone needs to pay their fair share of taxes, but if there is, it would be like this. It would be like you not taking advantage of writing off the interest on your mortgage. You're not doing anything wrong, but if you're not doing it, you're leaving a lot of money on the table.
Right. You know what? And somebody said this to me, and this really changed my mind about the tax code. He says when you look at the tax code as a tax code as things of things that you should or should not do, it can be overwhelming and confusing. And that's why the IRS in general, even the IRS agents, I should say in general, don't know the tax code very well. However, if you look at it from an investment point of view and you look at it that the tax code will incentivize you to invest where the government wants you to invest. You mentioned a home. They incentivize home ownership by giving us a tax break there. And they also incentivize us having rental homes or investment property because there's a tax incentive there or a tax break there. So there are all these tax breaks or incentives. And if you are looking for the incentives, then my golly, you can really reduce your taxation tremendously. For a while there, the government was giving a tax incentive or break if you bought a hybrid car or a electric car. And I don't know if they're still doing that. But, it's just another example of if you're looking for tax breaks, there's tons of them. Sometimes they're just local. Sometimes they're federal. But there's a lot of them.
There is. And again, to your point, as you said earlier, the time to do that tax planning is in advance, not after the fact, because after the fact, it's too late.
Yes, yes. However, if you do it too late, plan for next year, right? I mean,
That's exactly right.
Take that as a lesson and plan for next year. You know what? I want to talk about this because you have a strategy that I think is such a smart strategy. And that is, you advise your clients that they should increase their savings each year by whatever the inflation rate is or as a percentage of any pay raises. I want you to talk about this because to me this is such a smart idea.
So, when someone gets a pay raise, and we tell everyone this, look, you're getting a pay raise, you're being rewarded for the hard work that you've put in. We know the cost of living is going up. So each year you get a pay raise, maybe don't increase your savings by your full amount that you got a pay raise on, but you should definitely take a portion of that, reward yourself, and take the other portion and reward yourself later by paying yourself for part of that pay raise. What that essentially does is you don't see a huge impact on your bottom line. But 5-10 years later, when you look back, it ends up being a significant amount more money that you are saving on a monthly basis versus where you started. It's kind of a way to force savings. It's the same reason why 401ks are so successful for people, because it just automatically comes out of their paycheck. out of sight, out of mind, and it's easy.
Yes.
It's the same thing with anything that you do. So if you've maxed out your 401k, just set up a non-retirement account and have X amount of dollars automatically deducted out of your checking account each month, just like you would from your paycheck. And you see slow and gradual increases that end up being a very large increase over time. And that's how you're able to keep pace with the inflationary rate of savings. Because if you just stick to the same savings rate or same dollar amount for 20 or 30 years, you know, it's going to be obsolete.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that is such a smart idea. It's such a, what do you call it? It's such a, again, a good strategy to hedge against inflation, to keep you also aware of what's happening out there. And I love the idea of taking those pay raises and making them work. Look, bottom line, when you can get your money to work for you, that is, you know, what everybody's goal should be, number one. But when you can get your money's money to work for you, that's ultimately how we really start building wealth. I mean, getting your money to work for you is step one. Getting your money, the money's money to work for you is step two. And again, when you see a lot of these guys, when you hear how rich they are, they didn't do that overnight, even though it seems like it. But Warren Buffett, to me, is a great example of a guy who started with, if I remember correctly, he had a bunch of investors, and I think they got together – and it might have been $50,000 or $100,000. I can't remember, but it wasn't a huge amount of money. It was significant because this was back in the whenever it was, the you know 50s or 60s. But you fast forward, he took that whatever that initial money was, and now he's created billions and billions of dollars worth of revenue. So so to me, he's the example of just slowly going along the way, doing what you love to do, and he has amassed this fortune. He's amassed this fame. He's not outlandish. He's not, he's not necessarily always in the camera or anything like that. But he just quietly did what he wanted to do. And to me, that's the example. We're not trying to get rich overnight is how people lose their money, but trying to get rich slowly is how you keep it.
And if you look back at anyone that's successful, and if you know anyone personally in your hometown or national level like Warren Buffett, there is no secret formula other than being disciplined and having a long-term approach, because there's no such thing as get rich quick. That's you're better off just going to the casino. It takes time. And the powerful thing with compounding money is it looks like a little bit at first, but 10, 15, 20, 30 years later, if you've done all the right things and you stay disciplined, anyone can amass a certain amount of wealth that can help them get to that road of financial independence.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny you should say that. There is no rich quick scheme, but there is a get quick poor scheme, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. That's not hard to do.
That's not hard to do. And you mentioned the casinos. Those casinos are built on individuals trying to get rich quick, right? They're built on people who got poor quicker.
That's right. There's only one machine that pays at the casino, and that's the ATM machine.
I like that. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what you got to keep in mind. Oh, that's funny. It's all get out. You know, let's talk about this, Eddie. When you're sitting down with an individual, and let's say it doesn't matter whether they're 20 or they're 50 or they're 70. And I mean, I guess it does because obviously the time's on your side. But, you know, let's say that somebody who is, let's say that they've gotten their kids out of the house. And, you know, bottom line, they've paid for college, they've paid for all this thing, so they're essentially starting now at zero. They're probably, you know, in their late 40s, mid-50s, and they're thinking to themselves, I've blown it. I don't have a chance for retirement. I what do you say to people who are, you know, kind of starting over after kind of in midlife here?
Well, you know, that's kind of the dynamic that has changed in our business over the many years is, with life expectancy numbers being what they are today, someone in their late 40s, early 50s still has an opportunity to catch up and save quite a bit of money to make their retirement years what they hoped it would be. Because let's use the example of college. So, for example, if you're paying, you know, what's college today on average? $40,000 a year if you're lucky for a college, we'll say. So if you're spending $40,000 a year on education, then you know as soon as that child gets their diploma, you have $40,000 of disposable income that you can start saving for yourself. So what you're doing is you're catching up for lost time by taking the money that you've been accustomed to paying to the school and paying to yourself. Because the fact of the matter is, you know, depending upon gender, the life expectancy numbers we run off of are between 83 and 85. So if someone's 40 years old or in their late 40s, you know, they've got about 40 more years to live. So that means, you know, 15 years to save and then still plenty of time to enjoy retirement. So that dynamic has changed. So if you're in your late 40s, early 50s, it's not too late.
Yeah, yeah, and I like that. And thank goodness, good news is you probably still have plenty of time, and it's never too late. I mean, look, having some money is better than having no money. Having some retirement is better than having no retirement. And so, you know, don't put it off anymore, right?
Exactly.
Eddie Gabor, it's been a blast having you on the show today. Looking forward to having you back and talk more about tax strategies and helping people with their money. Eddie, if somebody wants to find out about your group, the Key Advisor Group, where do they go?
So they can go directly to our website, which is www.keyadvisorsgroupllc.com. And if they go on our website, they'll see all the information about myself, my firm, and our contact information. And thank you for having
me.
I've enjoyed being on here.
Oh, you bet. Key Advisors, that's with an S, keyadvisorsgroupllc.com. Eddie Gabor, we'll have you back again, my friend.
Thank you.
Good stuff there. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're off to the races after that.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Caller Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. Welcome back. I'm excited for my next guest, Henry Lawson. Henry Lawson is the co-founder and CEO of Autograph, the provider of user-generated profiles and the profile cloud. Henry was previously worldwide president of Donovan Data Systems, building transaction volume up to $85 billion per year. He received a degree in mechanical engineering from Trinity Hall, Cambridge, and then his MBA from Harvard Business School as a Baker Scholar. Henry Lawson, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
You bet. So let's talk about, what is Autograph? I mean, it says generated profile. I mean, yeah, user generated profile, but that, I don't know, seems like an everyday thing to me. So why use Autograph? What does it do for me?
So Autograph is essentially turning the process of your data on anything to do with the web upside down. It's making the user in control of the data and the profile that is used to actually decide whether something is relevant to them. It's putting the user in control of that data. And that is a fundamental change that we're seeing. You know, consumers are taking back control in so many different ways. Consumers are railing against, the black box and the big corporations, basically having data and not giving them any say in the data, the content, any of the things, the ads, the content, any of the messages that they receive. So what we do is we provide a way for the consumer to basically say, look, this is what I'm interested in, And by actually saying that, the company is able to make sure that the experience for the consumer is relevant. And when that happens, magic happens, because the consumer sits in and says, hey, look, you've actually understood me. And the company actually is able to deliver something very, very relevant for the consumer and get great marketing results. So we deliver great marketing results with a whole level of respect for privacy and trust. And that's what the Autograph story is.
All right. So how did this come about? You're sitting around, and obviously you had this epiphany, this light went off, and you said, look, we need something like this. So what was happening that kind of sparked this?
Sure. Well, it's interesting. You're talking in the intro. Thank you for the intro about my being the president of Donovan Data Systems. You know, when I started with Donovan, which is essentially sort of the back office of the advertising industry in 1995, we were processing about $40 billion of transactions, and zero of them were digital. None of them were digital. It was just TV and radio and newspapers and billboards. And I watched basically during the time I was President Donovan going from, you know, 0% of the media buy up to digital becoming about 30% or 40% of the activity. But at the same time, I watched the response rates of consumers to those ads going down and down and down to the point where we've got to now where, you know, about 1 in 2,000 ads actually gets clicked on and the rest of them are never actually looked at. And that is that's a travesty, really. When I left Autograph, I basically came to the conclusion, look, there is a way that we can use the data that is available, and there's loads of data, there's data spinning off from everything that we do, but we could use that to actually make a better experience for consumers. If we got the consumer involved, it would be much better still. And it's that last part that is the unique part of Autograph. And the realization was that we as consumers actually have less and less say in what we're able to actually see. You know, in the old days, if you didn't like the ad on the TV, you just changed channels. But when you go onto a website, what's served to you is determined by a black box, and it's out of your hands, and consumers feel out of control. And we thought that there was a better way of going about this, and that's what led Brian, Tom, and I, who founded Autograph back in 2011, to create the company and to build essentially this set of technology that just makes the world better. If that's not too grand a claim.
All right, so let's talk about this. All right, so as a user, I go to where? Where do I start? Do I go to autograph.com or where do I go to start this process?
No, so essentially our technology is used by the companies, and they invite you as a consumer to create an autograph, to create your own profile. We've had one of our clients, which is a mobile carrier, actually do this, actually inviting people to vote to create their profile on, strangely enough, Tuesday of last week, which was obviously extremely topical. We've got people actually finding out what their Christmas personalities are with our big supermarket client in the UK. We've got people who are actually going in and finding great offers on a very fancy shopping street in London. It all depends on the individual circumstance, but you're invited by the company to create an autograph. And once you've created that autograph, that company actually makes a bond with you that they will use that profile that you've given them to be very respectful of you and to provide you with content that is actually relevant to you based upon that profile. And that's the way in which it operates. So, you know, you'll find increasingly over time, you'll find the Autograph profile with mobile carriers, with TV companies, with retailers, with banks. We have one with an insurance company where you actually find out about the kind of insurance buyer you are, the kinds of things that interest you in insurance. So you've got a unit like that where no one's terribly interested to something like a Christmas campaign when people are very interested. But the answer is that the profile really, really is important so that the what's served to you is relevant to you.
I like that. I like that. And so let's talk about some of your clients. Who are some of your clients? You mentioned mobile and stuff like that. I don't know if you have some names you can toss out there, but who's using Autograph now to serve their clients?
So the very public example that we can talk about is a shopping street in London called Regent Street. And Regent Street was built in the early 19th century by King George III, and to this day is owned by the Crown Estate, which is the property company which is held under trust for the nation and controlled ultimately by Her Majesty the Queen. Fancy Street, you know, all the top brands are there on that street. And essentially, the experience that people have on Regent Street is as you walk up and down the street with the app on your phone, you are told about things in the stores that are relevant to you. Now, lots of people claim to do that. There's, you know, if I had a buck for every time I'd been to a conference and somebody talked about Starbucks giving you a free latte every time you walk past a Starbucks store, then we wouldn't need to have started Autograph. But the whole point is, but the whole point is that actually, as you're walking up and down 200 stores in the street, if you got pinged by every store, it would drive you nuts really quickly. So what we do is we make sure that the process, we only actually alert you to something that's on that street if it is directly relevant to you. If we know from our technology that there's a 95% chance that you are going to say, hey, I want to know about that. And that's the crucial trick that we achieve is the trick is putting the consumer in control means that the retailer or the mobile phone company understands what their what is relevant to their consumer or not. So Regent Street is a very exciting example. We've been public before. We've worked with Vodafone in the UK, which is one of the largest cell phone providers. And we are currently working with one of the big cell phone providers in the US. Unfortunately, we're under a non-disclosure agreement, despite the fact that millions of people have actually seen this now. But we are under non-disclosure agreement. I'm afraid I can't tell you who that carrier is.
They'll announce it later when they're ready. Now, but let's talk about this too, because you had I don't know if it was you or maybe one of your co-workers there, one of your partners. One of you guys appeared on Shark Tank. Is that right?
Don't think so. No, I don't think so.
No? Okay, misinformation. All right, misinformation. Just that's why I asked. All right, that's good.
I've sat in front of plenty of venture capital. We're very well funded with two very, very good venture capital firms, Voyager Capital and Rally Capital. But I've sat in front of many venture capitalists, which has felt like Shark Tank. But I wasn't on the TV program. Sorry.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
But,
all right. So
but
bottom line
venture is, venture capitalists have got very sharp teeth, too.
That's right. That's right. If you're dealing with a venture capitalist, you are dealing with a shark. That's why, you know, but it's all right. They kind of have to do that because not all of them are successful. Let's talk about this real
quick.
Let's talk about the privacy sensitivity of Autograph. Tell me about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a user, do I have a lot of control? Talk about this.
Sure. So let's talk about the way in which these things have been done conventionally in the marketing industry. Essentially, marketers use your email. The reason why they ask for your email address initially when you go onto a new website, or they ask for your phone number, or they ask for some basic demographic information, is that they then go out and buy third-party data, which has been just a trail of your data exhaust, where you've been on different websites, or you've been in different experiences, or you've put searches out there, you've written it in emails. And they use the way in which they have that central identifier as your email address to be able to say, okay, I know these things about the person that has that email address. That is, if you think about it, a terrible violation of your privacy. The way in which Autograph works is we just ask you to do a very simple 30-second quiz, if you like, on a cell phone screen or on a computer screen, where you actually say, look, I like this, I don't like this. And it could be brands, it could be TV programs, it could be sports teams, it can be Christmas characters, it can be any of those things. But the result is that and only that builds your profile. So whereas Facebook will look at all of your interactions previously with all of your friends and actually determine a profile as a result of that, and Google will do the same with Gmail and your search history, we do it only with the information that's provided us to the consumer for that purpose. And that is we are fundamentally changing the privacy paradigm from one of, look, this is, you know, my data exhaust, my private, or certainly seems to me private data exhaust you're using, whether I've given you permission or not. That whole way of thinking is changing, such that now, both in the US with the new Federal Communications Commission, the FCC regulations, you know, any ISP, internet service provider, or any mobile phone carrier, or any big company that actually has FCC, is licensed by the FCC, now is going to have to seek an opt-in. And you're going to have to opt into allowing that data to get used. And, of course, the result is that many people say, hey, now you're asking me. I'm saying, no, don't do that. So we're changing. What's happening is that the regulations are tightening down on companies, left, right, and center. Europe has passed an enormous set of general data privacy regulations, but it's surprising how fast the FCC has moved, and the U.S. has actually overtaken Europe in this area quite recently. So what we've ended up with is a set of regulations which basically say the consumer has to opt into telling you what they want. You can't assume that they are happy for you to use that data. That fundamentally changes the game for everybody who's previously just been looking at consumers' data exhausts and making decisions based upon them. And we change that paradigm completely by letting the consumer declare what their interests are, what their affinities are, what they're interested in, what they want. And as a result, it becomes something where the consumer holds the whip hand, holds the power, and it is absolutely not the company that holds the power. Now, you would think from that the company would lose, and that's a lot of what the representations have been to governments for regulations and everything else. But it actually turns out, and we've now proven it, when you put the consumer in charge, they trust you more. They trust your brand more. As a result of trusting your brand more, they end up being very willing, much more willing, to listen to what you have to say, to click on the content that you provide them, whether that's a story, an ad, a special offer, whatever it might be. And by they're more willing to, I mean between 6 and 25 times more willing to actually click on something than they would otherwise. So it turns out that giving control back to the consumer is an enormous win for the company as well, for the corporation as well. And that is a big difference between the view. Most companies regard giving consumers more privacy as something that they're going to lose something. And in fact, when they do it the right way, it turns out they win something. Because when you show people that you trust them, they start to trust you.
And yeah, no, I love that. I love that because it is ultimately that whole thing of trust. Let's talk about this. I want to kind of shift our conversation from talking about autograph to talking a little bit about how you build it up. You talked about getting some venture capitalists, and so I want to, you know, talk a little bit about some of the struggles that you had getting this thing off the ground, maybe some advice that you would give somebody who's got a tech startup who's looking for some VC.
Yeah.
Give us some thoughts on that.
Well, I think by their very definition, entrepreneurs of startups, you know, have a vision for how the world is going to work at some point in the future. And you kind of, you know, you're absolutely certain that the world is going to change and become that way. And, you know, we're fortunate that we're now seeing the regulations as well as consumer sentiment, as well as the polls and you know, the journalists and everybody else coming round to the point of view that privacy is more important than it's been in the past. So you have this view of the world as an entrepreneur, but there's one thing that you cannot control. And the one thing you cannot control is time, because it takes time for change to take place. So the one piece I would always emphasize with anybody starting a business, and it's been true for Brian and I and Tom inside this business, you know, we founded it in 2011, and we said, look, you know, give it 3 years and everybody's going to want this stuff. You can just see that the seeds are being sown right now. In 2014, it's going to be really coming. Well, the reality is our business is going like crazy now, but it's only been really growing in 2016 like crazy. And it's actually 2017 is really the year of Autograph because of all the regulatory changes that are going on. But, you know, that's 6 years out. We thought it was going to be three. It turned out to be six. So the one
right.
thing, you can envision what the world is going to look like until you're blue in the face, and you should do that. But the thing you can't control is time. So always build your business plans such that they are resilient to things taking a lot longer than you expect. Because if you don't, it's almost certain, and you know how many startups do you hear this from, it is almost certain that you're going to run out of money before you actually get to the change that you're expecting to take place. And so
that's
time, looking at time and being very, very conservative about time is the most important. It's not about wanting to get more money in the business so you can actually put more money on the fire, because the reality is you can't, as a startup, change much in that time dimension. It's the piece that's almost completely out of your hands.
Yes. You know, the ultimate lesson, you know, that I have learned, I've learned two lessons, and these are, I want to say they're accurate. I want to say all the time that I can think of, it's never so good it can't get better, and it's never so bad it can't get worse. So that's one of the universal truths that I've learned. And
yep.
no matter what
yep.
your plan
True.
Is, when you're dealing with a business, a startup, a sale, you know, it always takes longer and it costs more than you thought. I mean, you know, how many of us have decided to you know, you're going to buy a house? And you have this budget to buy a house, and before you know it, you're way above that budget. It costs more than you thought. It took longer than you thought. The same thing especially for a startup. I mean, I think you gave a great example. Hey, man, by 2014, we're going to have this thing up and running. Here it is, 2016, and you're saying, man, 2017 is going to be our year. So it's always more than you anticipated, and the reason it takes longer and it costs more money is because I think people generally discount how much energy it's going to take. You think that, hey, I'm going to be working 40, 50, 60 hours a week, and you probably need to, you know, you need to duplicate yourself times 10 to really get it up and running. It just, it always takes longer, right?
Yeah. It does take a huge effort. But I think a lot of entrepreneurs I meet, you know, sort of say, well, if we just raise more money, then we'd be able to accelerate the progress. And actually, there's a kind of natural pace to the way in which progress takes place. So people, you know, there's no doubt you have to work hard. Oh, my God. And with the company, you can tell by my accent that I'm originally from England. And the way in which the company, our company's built is, you know, we started from day one with offices in Seattle and London. Well, that has the disadvantage that we're in two separate offices, you know, 9 hours flight apart. But it does have the advantage that we're 8 hours of time zone apart. So we're able to actually cover 16 hours a day. And that's been a huge advantage. But you have to accept the fact that, you know, this is a 16-hour day occupation. This is not something that's, you know, that expect that as an entrepreneur. It will be a you know, your entrepreneurial journey will be a 5 to 8 year sprint, working 16 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week. And if you anticipate that and you're prepared for that and your family around you is prepared for that, that's great. If they're not, then it can cause the most incredible tensions. And we've certainly found, you know, I've got an incredibly supportive wife and family, my children, and are able to do it. But it's so important for people to actually be prepared for that, prepared for that intensity of the entrepreneurial experience.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? And I'm glad you said that, because it is an intense experience. And I love the fact that you said that your family and your kids and everybody needs to be on the same page. They need to know what's coming. Henry, it's been a blast having you on the show. Looking forward to having you back in 2017 to catches up on Autograph Success. Henry Lawson, thank you so much.
That would be fantastic. Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
You bet. You bet. Good stuff there from our guest today, Eddie Gabor and Henry Lawson. Really enjoyed talking to both these gentlemen, and getting into the nitty-gritty there with Henry Lawson was a lot of fun. About what it takes to build your business, especially in startup mode. And, you know, as entrepreneurs, as Henry said, we're always in startup mode for the most part, right? That's some of the good and some of the bad. Anyway, remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.